I'm Peggy Clark, and welcome to The Bridge. The Bridge pairs wise women and a few good men from different generations and geographies into revelatory conversation about what matters most. The Bridge is a podcast of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. This episode is a special episode of The Bridge that was recorded at the Rockefeller Connected Women's Leadership Conference in front of an audience in the beautiful Rockefeller Foundation Bellagio Center in Italy. One of our guests on this month's episode is Fumzile Mlambo Nguka. Fumzile is the United Nations Under Secretary General and Executive Director of UN Women for the past 6 years. Prior to that, she was actively involved in the first democratic government in her home country of South Africa. She was first a member of parliament, then a former minister, and eventually deputy president of South Africa. Throughout her leadership, she has never lost focus on increasing economic opportunities and rights for women. Also joining us in this month's episode is Dr. Ala Marabet. Ala is a physician, a feminist, and one of the 17 Global Sustainable Development Goal advocates appointed by the UN Secretary General. She's an ardent champion of women's participation in peace processes and conflict mediation, and she's a voice for Libyan women. And now we turn to our live conversation at the Bellagio Center. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to The Bridge. So let's just start by grounding ourselves. What generation are you from, Fumzile, and what defines your generation?
Well, my generation in the South African context was that generation of the Soweto uprisings, for those who followed South African history that was thrusted into the front line of the struggle to end apartheid. Mm-hmm. Thank God we were young then. We didn't have bonds to pay, children to look after, because we threw ourselves into the fight against apartheid with everything we had. Mm-hmm. And we actually learnt a lot there about fighting for something you believe in, even though at that time the end was not in sight. Mm-hmm. But we actually believe that the right can triumph over wrong. Mm-hmm. And that was sustaining.
Wow, beautiful. That's a remarkable history.
Incredible.
Ala, what generation are you from and what defines your generation?
So I have to follow that now.
Yeah.
By saying, like, I'm a millennial, and we're defined by hopefully being dynamic, but also usually being a little broke, and a little curious, and, you know, we're trying to find our place. It's not as incredible, I think, a story, but I think what's most interesting about our generation is we were born in the time, like, between some pretty huge advancements in technology, but also fundamentally different social realities on a global level. So when I think to my parents' generation, they were so well-versed in their immediate politics. Mm-hmm. They knew everything about the country that they lived in. They knew everything about their city. And I think what defines our generation is recognizing that the world is so much bigger than we thought it was, mm-hmm. and a realization that we also are accountable for one another in a different way. So I think it's a lot more global, potentially, than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So, Ala, let's talk with you. You were really, at a very young age, very outspoken about women's rights. So what sparked the fire in you to care about rights or to think about the fragility of rights? What was the beginning of that in your own personal life?
I think ultimately, I mean, my parents moved from Libya to Canada before I was born. And I think growing up as the child of immigrants, particularly from a country that is a dictatorship, you are often reminded what happens when people are robbed of their rights and robbed of their dignity. And your whole childhood is defined by this belief that you have to be worth the sacrifices your parents made. And so I think being put in a position where you find yourself devoid of those rights, you begin to say, you know, my parents didn't sacrifice everything they did for me for this to happen. And so when I moved back to Libya at 15 in when I was in my final year of medical school, 5-6 years later in 2011, and the revolution broke out, a huge part of me felt like, you know, entire generations had sacrificed their whole lives, had sacrificed relationships with their families, and I had been given the benefit of those sacrifices, and it was my responsibility to do something. So it wasn't necessarily the fragility of women's rights. I think it was more the strength of the strength of women's rights, and the fact that this was a movement and a platform that I felt was powerful enough to penetrate that community and that ideology.
And I think you told me that there were, that when war broke out, that there were some moments that were really profoundly impactful for you.
Yeah, I think the increasing sexual violence of a lot of the women I knew, and a lot of the women in our community, the fact that oftentimes in conflict, hospitals are the first place to be attacked or to be besieged. And at the time I was a final year medical student and the hospital was, you know, one of my second home. So that was obviously very important. I think ultimately, and Fumzile can answer this, I think, better than anybody. I think ultimately when there is a transition in any society, in any country, be it conflict or not, but when there's an extremely quick transition that shifts the social norms, everybody begins to ask themselves, what can I do? And I would hope, and I credit a lot of it to my parents, that when you ask yourself, what can you do, you think of the most beneficial thing or something that is ultimately better for your community or for your gender, for whatever, rather than what can you gain out of that? And I think that's a choice everybody makes.
And how old were you when that happened?
I was 21.
21, so very young. And Fumzile, what about you? What lit the fire for you and in terms of your whole lifetime of committed to rights?
Well, at a very early age, actually, or maybe let me say, you know, this thing of giving girls a lot of chores. One of my chores was help clean the house, cook, look after the baby and go to the YWCA. And going to the YWCA was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah. I mean, when you compare it to cleaning the kitchen,
absolutely. Because there were women who were feminist, who were initiating us as girls into understanding how to represent ourselves and our voices as girls. It was a relatively low-income area, so there were class issues that we're dealing with. And because it was a racist state, there were also race issues. So I was introduced into race, gender, and class all at the same time. I didn't even know it had a name then. But it really helped, because from that time onwards, going to the Y was about argument, about making choices, and about being global, because YWCA is an international organization. For a lot of the time, at that time, we used to hear a lot about what was happening in Palestine, because the YWCA of Palestine was an important area of focus for the YWCA of South Africa, because there was solidarity between fighting in Palestine and fighting in South Africa. And my life changed then as a teenager. By the time I finished primary school, I knew that there were battles to be won, and there were people who were in solidarity with me that I also needed to be in solidarity with around the world.
Was there any person in your life, Fumzile, that gave you the courage at that time when you were young?
I actually think that the women that were our facilitators at the YWCA were really phenomenal. And also because they had to do this in a kind of like subversive way, because they were not supposed to be caught talking to us about these issues. So a lot of it was couched in scriptures. You know, it was like we're doing a Bible study and then they will sneak an idea and allow us to have a discussion. So it was a kind of consciousness raising that they facilitated. And you then learned to have them as your go-to people. To ask these questions. And of course, then as you grew up at school, there was a student movement. And then you just threw yourself into it.
That's wonderful. So, Ala, what about for you? Was there a person in your life that helped to give you the courage that we see in you today?
Well, I have 10 brothers and sisters, so I didn't have to go to the Y. I kind of had it at home. And when you were saying my life was about arguing, I was like, were you living in my house? I got very good. I jokingly call it the Murabit School of International Affairs, because I got very good at debate, at rhetoric, at negotiation. I mean, my brothers, if I went into how many stories, I would have to build up all my data sets. It was really incredible growing up in my household. So in terms of being able to build the skills, you know, that was by far the best thing, having to always kind of prove my point very effectively. And then I have an incredible mom. I mean, she has to be because she raised 11 kids, but more than that, she was incredible in the sense that she not once, when we were having a debate, would be like, stop it, it's not, she'd be like, okay, well, prove your point. Like, come on, you started the argument, prove it. And so the onus was always on you to be completely prepared and completely aware and incredibly sure. And I mean, my parents were just really good at that. So I would have to say my parents, I think.
That's great. You had a really awesome mom. We totally want to meet
your mom.
A dad
too. He never gets enough credit because he was always working to provide for the 11 kids.
Yeah.
But especially my mom. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So you both have really unique perspectives on this moment right now in the world for women. What do you think, Fumzile, about the progress we're making or the areas you're worried about? What do you think about what's happening with women in the world right now?
Yeah. Well, I have to start by saying that women have been able to stand up and show up to fight for what they believe in when it was and has been very difficult. The fact that we have women who are human rights defenders in every corner of the world, notwithstanding the repression that we have seen, is credit to the courage of women. And some of them have been able to rise successfully and become the formidable leaders of their countries. The fact that we have seen women entering into politics and under difficult circumstances, winning constituencies has been something that we have to celebrate. And even when women were not winning the battles, and the fact that the women talked and they raised their voices has just made it possible for all of us to have people that are role models and people that we can follow. And we are, however, not yet where we want to be and need to be. And the fact that women are not discouraged. I mean, we're here because we're not discouraged. We know that we stand in the shoulders of women who have paid a very high price, and we feel the responsibility to make the world better for both men and women, girls and boys, into the future. I mean, I have to pick up on something that is very specific and important for women, like reproductive and sexual rights. I mean, if you were to ask me about one thing that I think has really helped women to have a choice, is the availability of a contraception. Something that women can use to determine when they will have children. This is an amazing form of liberation. And the fact that when you did have access, you could administer it without the help of a husband and the government. Anything that you could have as a woman, which you could determine for yourself without the government and a partner, is awesome. So, and I think all of us of our generation and in spaces where we've been able to have access to family planning services, that has been huge, because then for the first time, women could enter the labor market and be there in a sustainable way. And that is why that is something that is worth fighting for. Because just the idea that there are women somewhere in the world who have no control and decision-making about their own bodies, who can have children that they are not prepared or ready to have or can afford, is a big setback for how just a woman can just plan their lives. Yeah. So I just have to sing. It's a simple thing, but I think it's something that we all understand, whether you're a mom or not.
So Alaa, what do you think about where women's progress is right now? Where are we seeing movement, and what are you worried about?
I think Fumzile said it so well. I mean, I do think there's an incredibly motivated movement, in large part because of the women who have built it over the past several decades. And centuries, to be frank, and the incredible work that's been done and all the gains that have been made. I think for me, the biggest challenge is oftentimes that because of the urgencies of reproductive rights, because of the urgency of girls' education, because of the urgency of climate change, and they are fundamentally urgent, we need to be working on them day in and day out. We sometimes don't have the time or energy or bandwidth, truly, to focus on a lot of those underlying root causes as to why women have been excluded and negated and their rights have been violated for so long. And so while we do some work on it, really architecting the foundation, challenging some of the religious manipulation and misuse that has limited women's reproductive rights around the world, regardless of whether you're in a developed or developing country, challenging the global military complex that has subjugated women and increased violence in communities, and particularly domestic violence. I mean, being able to really say there are huge things that we need to have the freedom to have these conversations about, and we need to have the space to explore alternative ways to do business, to do life, to do health, to do safety. Because right now, it always feels like, and I'm a medical doctor, so I give medical analogies, forgive me. But it's like if you go to a doctor with an infection on your arm, and the doctor only puts a Band-Aid. In a couple of weeks, you're gonna come and you're gonna need the arm amputated off. That's a medical reality. But if you actually get that arm diagnosed, you treat it systemically with antibiotics, and you treat it locally by actually debriding it, it takes more time, it takes more energy. You need to work on the local and the systemic at the same time, because I think that's the only way we actually start challenging the violation of women's rights and creating change that is sustainable, that does not go backwards, that we don't have to, you know, in 30 years, fight for reproductive rights again. Yeah. Like, my one wish in the world is my niece, who is four, my niece who is four should not have to come in 20 or 30 years and be talking about her right to reproductive health and her right to her own body. That should be fundamentally established, right? It should be a given, in the way that I think a lot of our mothers fought for it for us, and now it's coming back up in conversation, because a lot of these rights, a lot of these things we achieve just are not institutionalized. They are not, we cannot hold on to them. And I want us to be able to hold on to them. And I think we have to architect and dictate really the conversation.
Right. So you're working in the Middle East. One could argue that's one of the hardest places to be working on these issues. Are you worried about a setback in progress, or do you see some windows of hope in the region that you're working in?
So in terms of reproductive rights specifically, the Middle East is actually one of the easier regions, just in terms of a lot of the cultural and religious framing around abortion and things like that. So, but in terms of my general belief of a blowback or of a regression, I feel that globally. I think that, you know, because of what I said earlier about just the globalization, like the world we live in today and how quickly things move from country to country and space to space, I think when you have anti-women sentiment and rhetoric in one country, it crosses borders very quickly, right? And so if you have that playing on televisions, if you have that in the media nonstop, if you have it on social media, it becomes a norm, and it's already been normalized so much in our entertainment media, in our film, and in our television, that the fact that we have global politicians and figures who publicly spew things that are opposed to women's rights, opposed to women's reproductive rights, opposed to the protection of...
And get away with it,
of survivors, of sexual violence, etc., that does tell young men around the world that this is acceptable rhetoric. And it doesn't matter if they're in the Middle East, if they're in Canada, if they're in South Africa, the more we normalize that language, it becomes normal, and you cannot stop it. I don't think any woman around the world can say, you know, this shouldn't be said, when the greatest, you know, when the leading figures of the world are saying it and condoning it in such a way. So I see it as a global problem. I definitely think we need to have more conversations on how we speak to men and boys, how we challenge, I think, divisive male leadership, and how we challenge men who, I think, heavily exploit their positions to negate the roles and rights of women. And I think we need to have more conversations about racism and the way in which a lot of what you were talking about, how race, class, and gender so often are treated as one thing when really they're fundamentally different things. And there's different challenges and there's different solutions and they often play and feed off of each other, and we need to start challenging that.
I'm Peggy Clark and you're listening to a special live episode of The Bridge. If you like The Bridge, then you'll also enjoy our sister podcast, Aspen Ideas to Go, which invites you to learn, discover, and be entertained with its weekly show. Aspen Ideas to Go features compelling conversations from the stages of the Aspen Institute. Get front row access to the Aspen Ideas Festival and other Institute events, and listen to scientists, artists, authors, and politicians engage in deep discussion about the ideas and issues that shape our lives and challenge our times. Find Aspen Ideas to Go on your favorite podcast player or at aspenideas.org. And now, back to The Bridge.
2020 is a really important year. We're coming up on the 25th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration, where famously Hillary Clinton said, women's rights are human rights. And Fumzile, you as the head of UN Women are charged with thinking about how we enter this set of conversations in 2020. And I think you're coming from very different perspectives, Alaa and Fumzile. So tell me some of your thoughts about what needs to happen in the 25-year anniversary. And then Alaa, what's your feeling about it?
You know, the fact that 25 years ago, it was possible for 189 countries to actually come together and agree on a comprehensive program for gender equality, it was the first time ever, and it has never happened again. And that is why we, people of a particular age group, are very sentimental about the 25 years.
I love that because you said people of a particular age group.
Exactly. I'm being nice to us.
Of a particular experience.
Because these are the things that governments agreed they were going to do. We cannot throw this away easily because they actually signed and committed. So to the extent that there's never been any agreement like this ever in the world, this is something that we need to hold on to. And the fact that there actually is a critical mass of government that wants to make sure that they live up to those big promises that they made, they are even willing to be evaluated, to be shown where the mistakes are, the gaps are, so that they can correct, they can accelerate, and they can move forward. However, we don't need agreements every day. Life happens. Younger people don't even remember or know what was agreed to. So you also, at the same time, don't want to necessarily define anything and make everything hang in that agreement. But we have to make sure that we keep that agreement under our belt, because it's our mechanism to demand a certain degree of accountability. Because the pushback that we see now, it's actually countries walking away for something that they've agreed to do. And in some countries, people are actually even able to actually use courts to demand these agreements. Mm-hmm. And in some situations, win, in some situation, usher new laws that make them forward. So there is pushback. We have to push back against the pushback. That is our responsibility. So when we get into this 25 years where we have had progress, but not enough, it is about how do we make sure that we close the gaps? How do we make sure also that we take on the new issues that are important to younger people, as well as important to us, because we live in the same space, we are intergenerational, so we desire the same things, but they understand certain things better than us, and please tell us, you know.
Oh, don't worry, we will.
There's just stuff we don't get as well as you do. Some things come natural. Kids that were born into technology, they just have certain expectations. And the most refreshing thing about that generation that has been born with higher expectations in terms of what equality is about is the level of impatience that they bring into the fight. Mm-hmm. And that is precious. Mm-hmm. Secondly, this generation also brings with them the ability to use informal power. They don't necessarily particularly care to be part of organizations in some cases, even though I think it's important to be in organization because you learn to work in a team. But the fact that the power of one in the social media can actually propel change, that is important. And that kind of power sometimes can be more powerful than the power of the United Nations. If people drive a campaign on the social media, they can achieve something you can never achieve sitting inside a conference. And you need to give them the platform to actually make that happen, because we need to play good cop, bad cop sometimes, where the informal power that is out there in society pushes in a stronger way, and we inside are saying, that's what the people want. Let's get this thing done. People are waiting for us outside. So we actually need both sets of platforms to actually work together. And sometimes also not work in a collaborative way, because that on its own also propels change.
Can you react to that?
So Beijing, huh? I'm not mad at it. Like, I think, yeah, I mean, I think it's cool because I think it is really a leveraging and recognizing that things were agreed on and trying to hold on to those. I am a little mad at something, so I'm going to mention it. I think it's awesome to talk about intergenerational things and to talk about how we're going to ensure the inclusion of younger voices. That's great. But then there's always this caveat of, like, they're really good at media. And a lot of young people like me are not really good at media, but we're excellent at other things. I mean, we are doctors, we're lawyers, we're students, we live in this world, and as good as you are at experiencing the world as a woman, so are we, right? Or the world as a minority, etc. So I think we need to be very fair that being young doesn't automatically make you a tech genius. If it did, I would be a lot wealthier, believe me. But then, to add to that, I think the thing I really kind of want to caveat is it is great to have these conversations with tech companies, with governments, but it would be great to have them with companies. Mm. Not just tech companies, but corporations around the world, because in our world today, corporations have so much more leverage than most companies do. I mean, in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, people got a lot of their information from their government roundabout way or default. They got their resources, they got infrastructure, they got support, and now you don't get any of that from your government, to be quite frank.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
I think we need to be a bit more realistic about who needs to be sitting at the table. And I think when we talk about young people, we also need to recognize that young people lead a lot of those corporations. So there's ins in both ways. And that young people experience a lot of the things that we talk about. When you talk about domestic violence and gender-based violence, I mean, the highest age group for that is 16 to 24. Where are they in the conversations we're having, right? Where are they in the conversations? When we talk about financial access and resources, we know that if you give a young woman access early in her life, her ability to be in control of her own life and dignity and assets over time increases exponentially. So why are we not having those conversations? Why are they not leading the conversation about how do you get access? How do you start a company? Domestic violence in your community. What would make you comfortable enough to come forward? Why are we not talking more about girls' education and the fact that that, along with women's reproductive rights, is one of the most practical and cost-effective solutions for climate change? I mean, we isolate the young voice into a media narrative voice without recognizing that if we do not cultivate and support and amplify and recognize the agency of young women right now, we will not have a women's movement moving forward. A lot of young people today have multiple passions. They're excited about women's inclusion and they're excited about climate change. And they are going to go to the community that responds and respects their agency the most. And I really think we need to understand that and to build that into our programs and into our ideas.
I just want to agree.
Now that you're agreeing, we can move on.
No, I want to agree. That is why we're calling for international generation. Since 2015, for instance, just to quote a time where we started to institutionalize intergenerational forum, because we want more younger people, men and women, to be in politics. In fact, one of my biggest dreams is to have heads of states that are much younger than the many people of my generation. Part of the reason why in South Africa I opted out of politics at the time that I did, I just felt that it's time up for people like me. There should be room for younger people. Also, in terms of people that are driving the changes in the economy, in many countries, as I was saying, we actually have seen that when younger people are leading, they actually come with completely different value system.
You're welcome.
They want parental leave.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Just to start with that, at the UN,
I learned this from you.
I can tell you at the UN, the most refreshing thing is the young men in the UN, which I'm embarrassed to say, there are agencies in the UN that don't have adequate parental leave. Mm-hmm. And you know who's leading in the demand? It's the young men in the UN. Mm-hmm. So these are professional, young professionals.
But it's also super frustrating that people only start listening when it's young men who talk about parental leave, young women haven't been talking about it for decades.
No, of course, but also, I'm just trying to illustrate that.
I agree. I think
now
it's awesome, but
the age group that we are in is just not going to accept.
Yeah,
businesses.
It's changing. So let me ask you a question, Ala. What would make you not roll your eyes when Fumzile rolls out the work from UN Women for Beijing Plus 25? What would make you engage with the set of reports that are coming out and the set of activities? Really, you know?
So I would never roll my eyes to Fumzile, or else my mother would ground me. And she still has the ability to do that. So, I mean, I think it would have to be something that was built from the ground up in a very tangible way by a very inclusive group. And what I mean by that is looking at young women, women of color, women of different sexualities, non-binary, women from the corporate space, from the NGO space, environmental activists, people who work in security, people who work in health, recognizing that this conversation, and not necessarily women who identify as being part of the women's movement, women who are leaders in those spaces, and bring them into this conversation and say, okay, so what works in your space? What doesn't work? What do we need to do better? Because I think right now, unfortunately, a lot of the conversations, when we talk about the inclusion of young women or the inclusion of minorities, et cetera, the agenda's been built. And then they invite you in at the very end to like give your feedback or to speak on a panel. And it's very tokenistic. It's more about optics than it is about legitimacy. And I think in order for it to be credible, they really do need to build the agenda from the ground up.
Okay. Fumzile, for all the people that are listening to this and watching this and those that are here within the audience, what's your ask of them to help you in the planning for Beijing Plus 25?
For one, is to listen to this voice.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome, again.
And the people that are coming after her, for some of the new ideas that represent a particular worldview and experience. Mm-hmm. So that if you have been in the space for a much longer time, that does not give you the monopoly of answers to the problem and the questions that needs to be asked. Mm-hmm. And for us to teach, I was just telling you, I don't know if I was talking to you, that I have been in situations where young people have been asked to leave a meeting.
Yeah, you were telling me that.
Because they are young.
Yeah.
I mean, the most bizarre thing when it is actually the critical time to be in the same room to grapple with the issue. So this thing of inclusivity is actually quite critical. And I would also need us together to call for greater investment in the women's agenda, because the women's agenda is broke.
Well, I think we need to stop calling it the women's agenda.
You know?
I think we just need to be calling it economic growth and prosperity and climate change.
Yeah. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like,
absolutely.
I think we need to stop saying that girls' education is part of the women's agenda. Women's reproductive rights is part of the women's agenda. If you have reproductive rights in your family over time is more prosperous. If a girl is educated, the community is wealthier. I mean, you educate 10% of the girls in a country, the GDP grows 2 to 3%. If you educate equally educated girls around the world, you would have a higher economic growth than China and India combined. I think we need to to stop saying this is a women's issue and say this is a global reality. The reason we are constantly in recession or an economic challenge is because we are not fully educating girls. The reason that we're having climate change and realities like this is because we're not talking about things like reproductive growth. And we're not, I think we need to stop saying it's a women's agenda. It is a global, it's a family agenda. And until we take that on, I don't think we're ever going to get the resources we need because people keep putting it into the back door.
So the agenda that advances the rights of women is not getting enough resources. Mm-hmm. That is actually critical, because if there is no money, stuff won't happen. Mm-hmm. It's as simply as that. It's probably the most constant way in every part of the world. Mm-hmm. They just isn't prioritization of the needs of women. And as she says, if we are able to invest better, we will be able to get greater results. And those results are central to the whole of society, because this is not a side event. This is the plenary issue. The continuous pushing of the issues that affect women and girls into highly specialized issues for certain people who are highly initiated, instead of making it the issues that are sent. If you are a head of state and half of your population has as bad a time as women have in most countries, you can't call that thing you are leading democracy. Yeah. You know, because there's just too many people who are not getting the benefit of what the country promises everybody.
And I just want to add to that really quickly. When you actually do have effective leadership, and when you have women's rights and women's rights that transfers to effective political leadership, you actually have more successful and sustainable democracies.
For everybody.
You have more output for young men and boys in terms of prosperity. You have more output for boys in terms of education. I mean, I think what we often do is we often assume that the agenda for women's rights is fundamentally only about women's rights, when in reality, we're just trying to make the world better like we always do. Right, we just need a bit more help doing it.
Great. We end every Bridge podcast with a question for each of you. So, Fumzile, what's one hope that you have for Allah's generation? And what's one hope you have, Allah, for Fumzile's generation?
Well, I don't even know if it is a question. Maybe it is an aspiration that I have. That's what we experienced. They should not experience.
Oh, you took mine.
It cannot be. This generation shouldn't have to deal with unequal pay, really. You know, this generation shouldn't have to deal with normalized violence at home and everywhere. So there are just critical things that are in all societies that are a challenge for all women and men who care, that we actually have to win decisively. Yeah. Decisively, so that they don't recare.
Yeah. What's your hope for Fumzile's generation?
I say it to my mom all the time. I say it to all the women leaders I meet all the time. I say it to Fumzile. I think to write and record their histories. I think we often have the challenge, because of the histories that are recorded, of thinking that the world was built and made by men. And they're very good at putting that on pen and on paper. And I think a lot of leaders in the women's movement for the past several decades just haven't had the energy or time or bandwidth to sit down and actually write all the things they've done. And I think it's time that we have those, because we all know the power of role modeling. We all know the power of stories. And I fundamentally think you cannot be what you can't see or what you can't dream. And the more stories we hear about incredible women who have led nations and then led ideas and created platforms and done all of these things, tells young girls tomorrow and in 20 years and in generations way beyond mine that this was not only doable, but it was done and they could do it again.
Right. I'm so honored to have you here. This is really, really wonderful. We have time just for two questions. So let me open it up to the audience. Would you mind standing? And we have a microphone so they can hear you. Would you say your name and where you're from?
My name is Sierra Romershide. I'm with the Rockefeller Foundation. I have a question for both of you, but from crowdsourced from a friend who's South African, so directed a bit to Fumzile. She wanted to know, or we both wanted to know rather, what your thoughts are on the recent diluting of the language and the rape as a weapon of war resolution at the UN, and how you see the UN working with sort of international justice and law institutions to prevent this type of thing from happening going forward?
Yeah, maybe a quick answer.
Yeah. You know, the way nations votes at the UN is supposed to be consistent with the policies of the countries and the nations they represent. There's a big role for citizens of the countries that are pulling us back in the United Nations to actually hold their governments accountable. Because once they sit there in the UN and vote, we already lose the plots because you can't stop them from making it. So there has to be noise back home whenever they make these kinds of moves that in some cases they don't reflect even the wishes and the policies of their own countries. But where they do, it's not like everybody in those countries agree with these moves. So I think we have a responsibility, those of us who are at the UN, to constantly stay in touch with citizens around the world because we need them to help us to have their representative to be accountable for the rights of women. What happened in the UN in the last 3 days was truly, truly shameful.
Yeah, and citizens should vote.
Mm-hmm. Vote. Absolutely.
When you
One
can
more
vote.
Question from the audience, please.
I'm Catherine Wilkinson. I'm an author and climate activist. We've talked the last couple of days about the need for women's leadership on climate, or maybe even for a women's takeover of the climate movement and conversation. If you could take it over, or just speak truth to the entirety of the climate movement, what would you do with that? Mm-hmm. What would you say or what would you do?
Okay. Two sentences each. So, what would you do if you could take over the climate movement?
I wouldn't. I would find the most equipped woman who is a climate expert and have her be the one to do that because that's not my expertise. And I think one of the best things we can do is when we know capable women in that space, ensure that they are the ones speaking. So I would try to find people who are the most impacted, who have been working on it, to be the ones who had that microphone.
But I also think that there has to be sanctions for countries that are clearly sleepwalking the world into a disaster. The fact that they can be climate denialists and face no consequences when this is actually creating danger for all of society, there should be a way in which the people that are making the situation much worse face the consequences and are made accountable for their action. So the good guys, if you like, actually need to not allow themselves to be the ones that are receiving sanctions so that certain countries can continue with bad behavior, and the countries that are doing the good thing are actually not having the mechanism to sanction and to make accountable those that are likely to be causing havoc. I think we need more assertiveness on the parts of the countries that are on the right path, and the people. The young people are showing us now.
They are showing us. So, Alaa Fumzile, thank you so much. We're so honored to have you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for listening to The Bridge, a podcast of the Aspen Institute. Please be sure to join us again next month and to download other episodes of The Bridge from the Aspen Institute on your favorite podcast app. I'm Peggy Clark, and thanks for listening.